Darn your socks, you sweaty Brendas. Welcome to the Blind Bite Podcast. The weather has been glorious. It's been glorious here in Limerick. I've been getting an arse full of summer. I've been drinking vistas with my eyes, taking every available opportunity to just go out and walk, or go for a run, and to be as present as possible in nature. This is when mindfulness is easy. Early summer, when everything is absolutely beautiful and breathtaking, that's when mindfulness is easy. Not like fucking November, when I'm trying to be emotionally present with a rusted sycamore leaf resting on a piece of dog shit, or when blades of grass are a shade of grey. No, it's early summer. Everything is beautiful and wonderful and bursting with life. So I'm being a greedy bastard, going on big long walks and enjoying nature with every single one of my senses as a meditative activity, as a calming activity. And I've got a wonderful podcast for you this week, if you're going off on a little walk yourself, because that's what I adore about podcasts. As opposed to something you have to watch, you can stick this into your ears and go for a nice mindful walk. So this week I'm chatting with Hollywood actor Paddy Considine. Paddy's from Barton-on-Trent, which is near Nottingham. We had this conversation in Nottingham. Paddy's one of those actors where you watch something because he's in it. He's also a director, he's a screenwriter, a musician. His most iconic role is probably in Dead Man's Shoes, but he's been in House of the Dragon, Peaky Blinders, loads of stuff. He's won a lot of awards. I don't need to tell you who Paddy Considine is. Paddy also doesn't do a huge amount of interviews, but he is an actual fan of this podcast. He's a regular listener, he's a proper perpetual Brendan. So that's why Paddy is on this podcast. And Paddy is also autistic, which is wonderful. We got to chat about being autistic in the entertainment industry. It was a great night in fucking Nottingham. Again, it's that weird thing about my job. I don't wear a bag on my head for 99% of my life. This podcast is, it's just me and this microphone talking each week. I'm aware. I know there's a million people listening right now. Acast tell me the statistics, but I don't experience it as that. It's just me and my fucking microphone, and I have a very quiet, normal, everyday life. I'm sure I walk past people who are listening to my podcast all the time. I don't experience any of that. So going over to Nottingham, the whole fucking UK tour that I did 2 weeks ago, it's quite surreal. It's strange to me. It's strange to arrive in Nottingham and there's like 2,000 people showing up for my gig. And then me, the person without the bag, is reminded, oh fuck, you're this person called Blind Boy, and you're now in Nottingham, a place you've never been before, and you've got lots of podcast listeners here. So it's wonderful. It's amazing to be in rooms full of people who enjoy what it is I'm doing. Like-minded people who laugh at the same things I laugh at and who are interested in the same things I'm interested in. But it's also really strange. It's very surreal because it's not my lived experience of reality. Any notoriety that I have for my work, I get to wear it as a garment that I put on my head and that I take off. And 99% of my life, that garment isn't on my head. It's just when I'm doing gigs or if I'm doing a photo shoot or some shit like that. So Nottingham was wonderful. It was a wonderful surprise to see how many fucking listeners I had in Nottingham and Brighton and Bristol. It took my breath away completely. So thank you to the people of Nottingham for showing up to this live podcast I'm about to play. And thank you to my magnificent guest, Paddy Considine. And thank you to the artist, Andy Brown. Andy Brown is a painter who showed up to this gig and he painted the gig. Andy's been at one or two of my gigs. He's been at one of my London gigs. He's a painter and he listens to the podcast and sometimes he asks me, can I come to the gig and paint the podcast? So I say, fuck it, go on. So thank you to Andy Brown as well. I was supposed to have a sheet of questions, but fuck it, we'll just go for it.
Let's wing it, yeah. It's the best way, I think.
First of all, Paddy, thank you so much for coming along.
You're welcome. I couldn't believe I got the message from you to come and do it. So I'm a big fan. I listen to the podcast. I've read your book. So, yeah, I just sort of was elated. And then I thought, oh, shit, I've actually got to go and do it.
That's very flattering. But I have a plastic bag in my head. It's impossible to look silly. Don't worry. First thing I want to ask you about is, like, you have a ridiculously Irish name.
Yeah.
How'd you get a name like that?
Well, I was nearly... Well, my dad's from Limerick, for a start.
He told me about that backstage, and I wish he didn't tell it to me backstage. I wanted to find that out right now. I can't fucking believe that.
Yeah, he was from Limerick, my dad, and my mum's dad was from Dublin, so she was half Irish as well, so mostly Irish blood.
And your dad was full Limerick. Whereabouts in Limerick?
He was from a place called Munchin Street. I can't remember the area, but he was from Munchin Street.
So, like, I know Munchin Street. Most of that isn't there anymore, but I'm assuming your dad grew up in, like, the 30s or 40s, was it?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was a little kid.
Full on Angela's Ashes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, for real, like, that's Angela's fucking ashes.
Yeah, it was interesting what information we've had filtered about his life. You know, it wasn't the easiest of lives.
And you were born in Burton-on-Trent. What's it called?
Burton.
Burton-on-Trent. I can't. These English names for places. I've great respect, especially this part of the country and the proud Anglo-Saxon tradition. But we don't have places in Ireland that are called... Well, we probably do. Place on a river. It's just, initially it would have been in Gaelic and then English soldiers changed the name to something silly. So Burton-on-Trent... Burton. So the town is called Burton.
Burton-on-Trent.
And it's on the River Trent.
It is, yeah.
It doesn't sound like the type of place where there'd be a lot of Irish people.
I don't even know how my dad ended up there. There was a few Irish families, but I think he came over here initially just to get sort of labour work. He left his life in Ireland in his late teens, I think, and came over here and his brother followed him and then his sister followed and they just went to Birmingham to get labour work. And then somehow he found his way in Burton-on-Trent and met my mom and, you know, then we were born six kids.
Fucking, that's fairly Irish now.
That's very Irish.
Jesus. Did you have a sense or connection of your Irishness when you were a kid or was it just something you didn't think about?
No, I think I did. Yeah, it's kind of strange. I do, yeah, I do. And I think it was from, you know, they used to call my dad the Mad Irishman, which was...
was he mad?
He was fucking nuts, yeah.
What type of mad, though? Like,
well, he was mad. He was always out fighting. He was always getting arrested. And,
all, you know, the fucking classic cliches, for fuck's sake.
I'm
Jesus
sorry.
Jesus Christ, I was hoping for something different.
No.
Was he fond of the drink?
He loved a drink, yeah.
So he liked to drink.
Yeah, I know, he's fucking...
fucking hell.
Yeah.
And Lynn Limerick as well, on top of it, like...
He loved a drink and he loved a fight.
Man, is that how your dad spoke? Because that was perfect, Terry Wogan.
He did speak.
Because Terry was from Limerick too.
Yeah, I know. My
dad. We have a fucking Terry Wogan statue, man.
His accent was so thick and my friends were all scared of him. And so when he'd sit there sort of, and in their ears, it sounded like this, and then he'd sort of laugh at the end of his head, and he'd go, and they'd sit there and go,
fucking Father Jack.
And just sort of laugh at whenever he laughed, like waiting for the cues to sort of react how they thought they should react to him. But, you know.
Was it difficult being called Paddy? Because that's also a racial slur.
No, not at all. I embraced it. It made me feel like individual. I was
fair
only...
fucking play. You didn't go for Patrick or anything like that?
No, or... well, when I was born, my mum, my name for about 2 days was John Wayne. and probably one of the best things.
What do you mean? Like,
it was John Wayne.
They went straight fucking, let's give the second name as well.
Yeah. My mum was...
John Wayne Considine.
And she sort
That's
of,
a great name. John Wayne Considine's a great name.
She obviously loved John Wayne and my dad wouldn't let her have it. And then she says, well, I'll call him Wayne John. And he goes, you're not calling him that. And then it was Dwayne John.
Yeah, none of them work. You can't be Wayne John.
And my dad sort of eventually, probably one of the best things he ever did in his life, he went, no, he said he's Patrick. He's Paddy.
Patrick is good. Wayne John sounds like a dancehall artist.
It's not good, is it?
Yeah.
Wayne John. Yeah.
You can't go for Wayne John. That's interesting. John Wayne. Although John Wayne was a bit of a prick, but you've got the J and the W, but Wayne John.
Yeah, Wayne John, and then Dwayne. No, sorry, any Dwaynes or Waynes or
not? Right. I doubt Johns. There's any Wayne Johns in the audience.
Is there any John Waynes in here tonight?
That's a big move going for John Wayne.
Isn't it? Yeah, it really is.
That's like calling your child Brad Pitt.
I know. Yeah, it's stupid. So thank God he jumped in there.
How are you getting on with being autistic? I had to ask it.
It has its moments, you know. It's an ongoing thing. Well, you know, I wasn't diagnosed until I was in my mid-30s, I think it was.
But so, that was like 2011, wasn't it?
Yeah, something around. I'm not very good with, you know, for an autistic person, I'm not very good with dates and things. I'm more of those, one of those introspective type people. But I don't know, my wife would know the specifics of it. But
what made you go for it? Because the thing is, now a lot of people are getting diagnosed. Now it's something that's being spoken about. In fucking 2011, it wasn't really being spoken about. And as well, I'm guessing it was called Asperger's then too, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and now it's all under the autistic spectrum, which is...
Yeah.
I mean, you can't... You know why it's not called Asperger's anymore, don't you?
No, I didn't really care.
Know.
No, I just fucking
got on
with it.
Well, it's your man. There's that fly again, Paddy.
I'm not going to kill it.
We leave him off. He wants to be part of the fucking podcast. He's after landing on me, and he's landing on you. Let's leave him do his thing. A nice little Nottingham fly. A ghost of the lace industry. But yeah, your man Hans Asperger, right, he was a Nazi doctor, and when he was in the concentration camps in Germany and in Poland, they weren't too fond of people who were disabled. Like the Nazis would eliminate people who were disabled. So Hans Asperger, his job was to decide who is exterminated and who isn't. And when Asperger was doing this, he was like, not them ones. Those ones over there, I know they're a bit mad, but those ones over there are going to make great scientists and artists. So he had his Asperger's kids.
Right.
And that's where the diagnosis Asperger's comes from. So they changed it because it's like, that's a bit shit. You can't call it after that, can you? So it just became autism spectrum level one.
Yeah, under the umbrella. I suppose.
Under the umbrella of autism.
Yeah.
So, like, my see, the thing is, it's so different. That's the strange thing about it. Like, we're probably both level one autism, but are completely different.
Yeah.
In the things. I'm a big fan of facts, and I don't like talking to strangers. What are you into?
What am I into? Well, I'm not a fact guy, you know. I'm not a sort of stato in that same way, really.
But yeah, do you have a thing where you're like, I fucking love that?
Oh, if I get into something, I obsess about it, and that's it. You know, I'll go on these sort of, you know, some of them. The longest, like, I'm obsessed with a band called Guided by Voices. Mm-hmm. And when I got a thank you, even though I'm not a member of Guided by Voices, they're the greatest fucking band on the
very
planet.
Artistic behaviour. Jesus Christ.
So I will obsess to the point that...
Have you got to meet them?
Oh, yeah. I've met,
oh,
met,
great.
Met them a few times, yeah. And yeah, I've gone out and played like a festival that they did last
Fuck
year.
Off.
And, yeah, yeah. Me and my son went out, you know.
Fantastic.
I don't know if he'd like... But I came about it because my wife was looking into it. And because one of our children was showing sort of, and she started reading through these sort of, you know, I don't know what you call them, symptoms or whatever, but she just went through a list of things and she just looked over at me and went, this
okay,
is
yeah.
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My thing
That's
is like
very,
small
very
talk.
Very common. That's very common though.
Yeah. I can see on a stage and talk and things like that, but my thing is small talk. Like I've got a dog, you know, we've got this beautiful little dog. And our old dog, bless him, he passed away at Christmas. But we'd walk through the village. I adored having a dog. But the worst thing about having a dog was fucking meeting people in the street.
Yeah.
Who wanted to talk to you about whatever it was, dogs. Small talk.
Did you have a rehearsed a bit of conversation about the dog?
I'd just pull him away, you know. I go, come on, mate. Come on. What was his name? Bo, that was Bodog.
What type of breed was he?
A Cavalier King Charles.
See, I'd know fucking what I would do in that situation.
A rat boiler.
I'd have every single fact about a Cavalier King Charles possible. And then when the situation presents itself, that's all I talk about.
Yeah. See, I can't. I find the small talk stuff quite tough. So I'd avoid dog walks or give my wife the lead and go, yeah, you take him. So you can do the talking.
And that's it, really. Is like, so these are things that aren't pleasant for you, but to say that this isn't pleasant is labelled as eccentric, and then you end up avoiding things.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say you were you fond of a few cans at social events?
Yes, yeah. Very much. I mean, I would, at one point, I mean, I don't mind saying it. I've got a beer here, but my relationship with that isn't what it used to be, but...
You used to get very drunk.
I had to go to, if there was a party coming up on a calendar or anything like that, I'd just get nervous about it internally. And then, you know, before we'd left our house, I'd have a couple of pints. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just so I could walk through the door, it got like that bad at times. I'd always do this with my wife. Like, I'd send her through first and go, you go in first.
you do all the hellos and the introductions.
You do all that, yeah. And she's amazing at that. So she's had to put up with me and my bullshit for way too long.
But the thing is, Paddy, like, you're in loads of films and shit like that,
I know.
Right?
So the hardest thing, Blind Boy, is that I look like a walking contradiction. Because I'm a man who didn't really want to do... I make myself do these things because I won't succumb to it.
Of course.
You know? So yeah. I'll do stuff. And it's not like it's not a pleasure. I don't sit there and I'm in absolute hell. You know, I find my way to navigate it. But my alternative was just to sit at home and not do anything.
And I can't do that.
And I can't do that. I'm a father and I'm a husband. And I can't be that man for those kids. They can understand Dad and know how his mind works. Well, I'm very open with them, but I can't be that guy.
But also, I get the sense that you love the art that you make. You love doing what you do professionally.
Sometimes I love it, and sometimes I don't.
Really?
Yeah, I have quite a love.
What are the bits you love and the bits you don't love?
I suppose in my mind, I'm always looking for a slight escape or something. I'm always looking to sort of access that flow, if you like. Some jobs as an actor, I think as an actor I've done really, I'm not going to kick myself in the balls too much. I think I've done stuff that's really good, sometimes really great and solid. And I think I've also done shit. And I think that you can see when I'm invested and when I'm not. I find it very hard to fake things. And that's a weird thing for an actor because that's what we do. But you can tell when I'm fully invested in something and when I'm not. And that's all based around trust and the people I'm working with. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I've taken work on and I know even taking the work on that there's some kind of disconnect. And it's almost robotic sometimes to me when I act. I struggled with, because I never came to acting through a conventional way. Mm-hmm. I never went to acting school or anything. My friend literally put me in his second film. Mm-hmm. Shane Meadows put me in his second film, A Room for Romeo Brass.
But when you're talking about trust there as well, the fact that Shane Meadows is like a proper mate, was that part of that trust that gave you the comfort?
Well, yeah, because we'd been friends since I was 16 and he was 17 when we met. And because we'd been friends for that period, we developed a friendship at that time, and then we split off. It got a bit combustible, which it can with personality sometimes. And then we had a few years away from each other, then came back. And I went and did a photography degree in Brighton, and Shane was here making films. And I happened to come back, and I was cutting some short films in Nottingham. And he said, will you be in my next film? I had no real designs on becoming an actor then. I wanted to at some point, but I really didn't at that point. It didn't matter to me.
What did Shane see in you that made him ask that question?
I used to make him laugh. That was simply it. You know, we were a bit of a fucking handful when we were younger, you know, together. People either loved us or they hated our guts because we'd go in a party and take over it.
And you'd perform for Shane to make him laugh.
That was it, yeah. That was the thing that I was doing.
And did you, because I'm not far off that too, as in I hated being at parties, but also I went to them. I would drink a little bit too much because I was nervous, but also I'd be making everybody laugh. And when I was performing and making everyone laugh, it felt safe and okay. Even though that's strangely extroverted behavior, it worked for me.
Yeah.
Did you find something similar going on with that?
Definitely. That's really it. You kind of nailed it there. I would make him laugh and perform in such a way, and that was the thing that gave me confidence. And that's how I sort of drifted into it, and that's how I could be characters. I actually went through periods in my life where I didn't even speak in my own voice.
That's highly artistic.
Yeah. When I was a little kid, I was Rick from The Young Ones for about 2 years, which was fucking mental, you know.
And I'm guessing it really worked for you.
Yeah.
It's eccentric, but this is working for you, and now you're navigating the social fabric, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's how I did it. And then when I remember being at university, and I was Alan Partridge for years, which would be really annoying.
And were you doing this in a fun, performative way as well? Like, I mean, yes, you're Alan Partridge, but also you're the dude who has that impression nailed and you're making people laugh and that this is working.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked that. I had a friend who actually turned to me, one of my closest friends, and he was from Canviale, and went, "Do you ever talk in your own fucking voice?" And it didn't strike me. I didn't even know what I was doing.
Someone said the exact same shit to me in
college.
Well, when I started off with Rubber Bandits, even before music, when I was like 16, it was prank phone calls. And I used to do like 10 different characters, different accents. But that's kind of how I was all the time as well, just consistently doing impressions of teachers, whatever, making people laugh. And that's what worked for me. That's what brought me joy.
I was Steptoe. I was Harold Steptoe. And I had this the home economics teacher. And I knew she loved it. So I would memorize the script from the night before. It'd be out on a Thursday night on the BBC. Then I'd go in and I'd have memorized scenes from Steptoe and so on. And I'd sort of perform them in the class. And I could catch her sort of with her head down, smiling.
Brilliant.
And, you know, so,
and that
yeah.
was like an extra laugh because it's the teacher.
Yeah.
When the kids are laughing, that's great. But if you can make the fucking teacher laugh when they should be giving out to you, that's amazing.
You've cracked the code there.
That's a very pre-internet thing as well. Like, I often think about this with, like, I used to love comedy growing up, fucking Reeves and Mortimer, The Fast Show, whatever the fuck was on. And when, like, you could see a sketch on TV and it was the funniest thing you've ever seen, and you'll never see that again.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, when are they going to replay it? I don't know.
But you'd remember it.
You'd have to remember it. And people, like, catchphrases don't really exist anymore. But catchphrases were huge, because when you saw that thing that was amazing, you don't have YouTube. You can't send that scene on to your friend. You have to memorize that funny. Like, remember "Oh, Suit You, Sir" from fucking Fast Show?
Oh, God, yeah.
Everyone was doing that. But it's what I compare it to is, have you ever heard of a cargo cult?
No.
Oh, this is fascinating. So there's these islands in Micronesia, right? Micronesia and Polynesia. And there's tiny populations of people living on these islands. I'm talking maybe 400 or 500 people. And these people were uncontacted by the outside world for fucking years. So when World War II broke out, there's this civilization living on an island for a couple of thousand years, and all of a sudden they're seeing an airplane for the first time. And it was US soldiers who were in the Pacific theater of conflict in World War II. So what would happen with some of these tiny islands is a US airplane might land on this island, and then the people who've been living there, they've never seen another human, they don't know what a fucking airplane is. But the US soldiers, maybe they were different back then. They weren't being pricks. They were nice to the indigenous people. So the US soldiers would just go, "How are you getting on? That's an airplane." And then they'd be there with their airplane. The indigenous people are like, "I don't know what." They're assuming that the Yanks are God.
Yeah.
They're making this assumption. And then the Yanks would have chocolate. They might have Coca-Cola. And then they'd give this to the indigenous people. And then the war ended. And the planes left, and the Yanks left. And the indigenous people who didn't speak English were like, "What the fuck was that?" The fuck was that there for 3 or 4 years? So what the indigenous people started doing was, that was pretty class there when the men came down from the sky and gave us chocolate, because there's no fucking chocolate here. So what they began to do was to develop religious rituals based around what they'd seen. So they would create runways out of bamboo strips. And they would create like air traffic control, and they'd create these seriously all throughout like 1950s, 1960s, and they'd do this as a religious ritual. And then every so often, right, once every 10 years, some ship would like break down and the cargo would wash up on shore, and they'd find bars of chocolate and they'd find bits of coke. So they believed that this was from the gods. So that's a cargo cult. And that reminds me a little bit sometimes of how we used to repeat the catchphrases of, I know it's a stretch, but it's the same psychology. What you're dealing with there is cultural scarcity. These people had a monoculture, and they'd never seen anything outside of it. And the scarcity of something like different people or airplanes or chocolate bars, when we were watching comedy sketches on TV and you didn't have the internet, the scarcity of that meant you had to do the fucking League of Gentlemen sketch like a religious ritual so that you don't forget it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the water cooler moment was. And people like myself and yourself, we had real value because we'd go into school and we're the person who can do the impression of the fast show from the night before or Reeves and Mortimer or whatever. Yeah. And people really valued that. Now we're just annoying cunts. because people have got YouTube. You don't have catchphrases anymore. There's no need for it.
No, it doesn't exist. I mean, I used to. I know.
So that's my autism there.
Yeah.
What I just did there. I'd be doing that at parties, you know. So that's how it reflects in me. I'll start talking, and that worked for me because that was interesting, wasn't it?
It was very interesting.
So there you go. So. In social situations, I'd find myself just with a fucking barrel of knowledge of all these things. And when I'm doing something like that at a party, I'm anything but nervous. And then when it goes back to, what are you thinking about doing next year? What do you think of the weather? I'm fucked.
I'm done, yeah. It's like that middle age, you know, you have kids and then suddenly the next generation, you want to come around for a barbecue and you're standing there with some cunt who's...
I know!
And I'm like... You know, I don't have the tools to navigate.
But the thing is, too, you're getting older, so it's less appropriate for you to talk like Steptoe and Son.
I know, yeah.
When you're 20 in college, it's actually fine. But as you get older, it's eccentricity becomes more obvious.
Yeah.
And it's why I jumped on it when you said that your dad was a mad bastard. It tends to follow patrilineal lines. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Your dad could have been neurodivergent in some way.
Oh, I think he was.
He became an alcoholic as a way to cope with this. Or fighting was a way to cope with this. You know?
Yeah, I definitely think he was. You know,
was he eccentric?
Very. And he was a performer. You know, when I started making films of my own, I'd put a camera on him and film him doing monologues into a mirror, you know, into the bathroom mirror.
What would he talk about?
He'd talk about his arrest, you know. He'd talk about, you know, the incidents and... But it was like
was
watching.
Was he okay with that camera? Did he like
he loved
that?
It.
There you go.
He loved it. Yeah, he absolutely loved it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'd photograph him, and you know, when I started doing my photography, I'd photograph him, and he kind of loved it. Yeah.
Did you keep that footage?
Yeah, I've got it. Yeah.
That's amazing. So you're able to. How is it to go and look back at that?
I haven't looked at it for a very, very long time, so I don't know what it would be like. But I feel like I want to sort of get it out and show it to the kids, that this is your mad fucking granddad.
How long ago did your dad die? Don't mind me asking.
He died in, was it 2000, show? 2001? 2001.
Shell is his imaginary ghost.
She's out there somewhere. My crutch is out there. Yes. But the interesting thing... Oh, you ain't got time now, have you?
See, the clock was there, but it went.
It's gone off.
Unfortunately, there's a problem. I need to get a better watch. So I wear these fucking Fitbits, right? And the problem with this is there's no subtle way to look at the time because it requires kinetic movement. So there's no... Don't get one of these. The only way for me to look at the time is to go like this. Which is very... That's rude as fuck. I should be like this. No, I have to go, hurry the fuck up, Paddy. It's 8:30, so these people need a piss and a pint.
You need a drink,
And have a good argument about what the local Nottingham drink is. Because I love that you can't decide. We'll be back out in about 15 minutes to continue the discussion.
It is time now. We'll have a little an ocarina pause. we'll have an ocarina pause before we get back into that wonderful chat with Paddy Considine. I don't have an ocarina this week because I'm in my office. What I do have is a nail clippers and my metal mug, my Stanley thermal mug. So I'm going to use this nail clippers to navigate the rim of this mug and see if it makes an interesting sound. And then you're going to hear an advert for something. Oh, that's not nice at all. That's not pleasant. I think I'll just tap it instead. Support.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. If you enjoy this podcast, if it brings you distraction, mirth, merriment, entertainment, whatever has you listening to this podcast, please consider paying me for the work that I put in, because this is my full-time job. It's how I earn a living. It's how I rent out this office. It's how I bought this. I have a wonderful new computer this week. I got a new computer for the podcast that has a quiet fan. The fan on the last computer was really, really loud because it was full up of podcasts. The hard drive was completely full, so I needed a new computer. But thank you to everyone who's a patron of this podcast. Thank you to everyone who directly funds and supports the podcast, who allows me to have the time and space to fail. Because that's what it is, really. To do anything creative, you need to have time and space to fail. So all I'm looking for is the price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a month. That's it. And if you can't afford that, for whatever reason, don't worry about it. You can listen for free. Listen for free. No problem at all. Because the person who is paying for you to listen for free. So everybody gets a podcast and I get to earn a living. It's a wonderful model based on kindness and soundness. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. But I will say, if you're going to my Patreon page, please make sure you sign up as a paid member and don't sign up as a free member. That's not the same as listening for free. When you sign up on Patreon as a free member, you're just giving Patreon your data and it doesn't directly support this podcast at all. So if you are going to the Patreon page, please consider actually paying for it, not the free member thing. If you want to listen for free, just listen for free. That's fine. I want everybody to get the exact same podcast, whether they pay or not. Upcoming gigs. As you know, I'm having a very, very quiet summer. I need time off. I need time to drink nature with my eyes. Ficker Street in June on the 18th. That's down to the last tickets. Ficker Street in June on the 18th in Dublin. And then July, Set Theatre Kilkenny for two nights. Small little gigs. There's literally like 10 tickets left. I want to go down to Kilkenny. That's why I'm doing that gig. I'm going down to Kilkenny for two nights to play in the Set Theatre. I want to spend a couple of days in Kilkenny. It's a beautiful place. Specifically, what I want to see is there's a stone sculpture from the 17th century in Kilkenny Castle that looks exactly like Keith Duffy from Boyzone. And I want to see that in person. So that's why I've booked those two gigs. Like and share the podcast. Tell a friend about it. Follow me on Instagram, Blind by Boat Club. Leave a review. All that type of crack. Back to the chat with Paddy Considine. Actually, one thing to clarify, in the second part of this podcast, I mistakenly say that the dog breed, the Cavalier King Charles, was a French breed. It's not. It was the Brits who bred that dog.
That's the second beer you're after spilling tonight now, Paddy. Did you get your Castle Rock? I was trying to learn about the history of it backstage. Yeah, no, because when I was saying, like, what's the drink of Nottingham, what I meant was, like, what did your granddad drink and what did your dad and your ma drink? You know what I mean? That type of drink. So is it Castle Rock? You need to sort this shit out, Nottingham. Like, fucking hell. That's amazing.
You'll get a good pint in Burton-on-Trent.
Now, he was saying in Burton-on-Trent they have several breweries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A brewery town.
Yeah, you can get a nice pint of Bass, a pint of Worthy. Yeah, you'll be all right there.
What's is that Marston's. Worthington's Bitter? Is that what that is?
Yep, yep.
I've only seen adverts for that.
It's a well, that's what Burton is. It's a brewing town.
Did you have a monastery at one point? Monks used to love making beer.
The Abbey. Yeah, the Abbey was the monastery.
There was an Abbey there?
Yeah, the Abbey, yeah. They used to roll the barrels under the river, apparently, yeah.
Fuck off.
Yeah, there's all tunnels and that, yeah. I've never been down
Actually,
there.
Actually, when I was researching the tunnels of Nottingham, that came up quite a bit. It was used to store beer. Yeah. Are you proud of your history? It seems like a pretty cool place to me. You can play the Nottingham in Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Were you aware of that? It's called Snottingham. See, I don't know. What I know a bit about this part of England. I just haven't been around it. Today I started getting obsessed with an area on the east. It's on the east. No, no, no. The middle of the west. Are we in the Midwest? Wait, no. Are we in the middle of the east?
Yes, yes, yes. We're verging on that.
Maybe. The Fens. We're not near the Fens, are we?
No.
Are we a good bit away from there?
Yeah.
I'd love to have a crack at the Fens. It just seemed... Have you ever been to the Fens?
I've been to the Fens. Yeah, I went to see Reggie Cray in prison around there. Yes, I did.
What? Come on.
With a bare-knuckle gypsy fighter.
Yeah, why did you do that?
Oh, well, at the time, I was doing my photography degree. And there was a bare-knuckle fighter from Utoxica called Bartley Gorman.
Oh, I've seen.
Yeah.
I've heard
well,
of
Shane
him, man. He's a legend.
Of great short films about him. And I went and did some photographs of him when I was doing my degree. And one of them ended up on the... I took a photograph of his hands holding a rosary. And he cut his hand on a thorn bush, pulling out some wood. And so it looked like, you know, the stigmata sort of thing, you know. I took this picture and it ended up on the front cover of a paper called the Staffordshire Bugle. Yeah.
So,
and then somehow the Staffordshire Bugle made its way to the prison in Lincoln, I think it was, or somewhere around there. But and Reggie Cray was in prison there. I can't remember the name of it. Waylands or something like that. And he apparently saw this newspaper and he wanted to meet Bartley Gorman. And he said, I want to meet the man who took that photograph. So I ended up going with my friend Bartley on a road trip to go and see Reggie Cray in prison. And it's interesting.
What was that like?
Yeah. And on that, it was strange. It was really strange, you know, because it was like he was still holding court in his living room.
Wow.
So, you know, he was like...
Well, even for him in prison to go, I want to meet these people and they have to come and visit
up.
Me, yeah.
But when I left, you know, he gave me a hug. He goes, anything I can do for you, you let me know. And I thought, fucking hell, he still thinks it's like...
Was that intimidating in any way? Or
He was a lot older then, you know. And
yeah.
He had these young guys around him and that. But he used to ring my old digs in Brighton. Like, because
Reggie Cray is just ringing from prison there, lads.
He'd ring up and I'd pick up the phone and he'd go, is that you, such and such? And I'd go, Reggie? And he'd go, yeah, what time are you in court tomorrow? And I'd go like, oh, Reggie, I think you've got the wrong number. Reggie? Yeah, well, I'll get about 9:30. What? I'll see you there. And then I'd have to ring his wife and go, Reggie, Ronnie's just rang me. I'd ring his wife and say, Reggie's just rang me, I think he's kind of got me mixed up with somebody else, just so you know. And then there was a guy who I shared the digs with who would never, he was an ignorant fucker, you know, he was rude and that. He'd answer the phone, he was really rude. And I went to his room and knocked on the door. I said, I'll just warn you now. I said, if that phone goes and someone on that phone says they're Reggie Cray, I said, it's Reggie fucking Cray. So don't be an arsehole to him.
Can you tell me a bit about your process? I know that the film Tyrannosaur, right, is very, very dear to your heart.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us about that. Tell us about the process of making it and why you love it so much. That was Olivia Colman before.
Yeah, that was kind of the thing that sort of, I don't really, you know, but it definitely brought her to a different kind of attention upon her, you know, mm-hmm. after that film.
Because she was Sophie from Peep Show before that.
She was on the Peep Show.
Yeah.
I didn't even know who she was, to be honest with you, when I cast her in it. I just, I remember we went through to the read-through for Hot Fuzz and I'd written the short film, that Dog All Together, that became Tyrannosaur. And we literally walked through the door at the same time. And I held the door and she went, after you. And I went, no, after you, you know. And mm-hmm. we had this little exchange and I just looked at her and I went, and then I rang my wife and I said, I found her. And she goes, who is she? I said, I think her name's Olivia. She goes, what's she done? I goes, I think she's in Peep Show. I watched Peep Show after, you know. It was a great show. But that's kind of how it sort of happened. It was that simple. It was just passing through a door at the same time. And we made the short film and then I went and wrote the feature film. But the reason I started writing, I wrote my own feature film is because I was making contributions so much to other people's work. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd worked with a director called Pavel Pavlikovsky and I was basically sitting with him at night and writing the next day's scenes. And I'd had a similar relationship with Shane where it was very improvisational and particularly on Dead Man's Shoes, you know, we'd kind of... you know, created a plot. And
I didn't want to bring that up in the way that I didn't want to bring up.
When
I was talking to Johnny Marr, I'm like, I'm not going to bring up Morrissey, so I didn't want to bring up Dead Man's Shoes. I didn't want the obvious question.
I know.
I fucking love it. It's brilliant. It's fantastic.
You can't avoid it.
Yeah. But
I don't know.
I didn't want to do that podcast, you know what I mean?
It's all right.
What you're saying there is that you were effectively writing, but you weren't recognizing it as writing. You were the relationship you were having with Shane Meadows and stuff and putting scenes together. Had you not gone, hold on a second, I'm actually writing here. Maybe I can have a crack at this myself.
Yeah, that's what eventually happened. I just went, you know, I've got a film in me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because I contributed to these other films, I just thought I'm ready to now go away and write my own film.
And what did that, like, the very first spark of, getting something from your head and turning it into a film, did you sit down and write a script? Did it begin with a script?
Or? Yeah, it was just a script. I mean, it started as a short film that I wrote, and it only took me a couple of hours to write it. And at the time, I was working with Gary Oldman on something, and mm-hmm. I showed it to him, and I said, what do you think of this? And he went, I love it. He goes, who do you want for the lead? And I says, well, I don't think it's you. And he went, no, of course it's not fucking me. Who do you want? And I went, I think I want Peter Mullen for it. He went, perfect. And then it just sort of came together, you know. We were in Toronto. I was with the producer, Mark Herbert, and we walked into Peter Mullen on the street. And I said, Peter, have you read my short film? He went, yeah, it's fucking great, bro. It's brilliant. I'm like, you ain't fucking read it. I want you to be in it, you know, we've got to make it. And that's how that relationship started with Peter. And then Olivia came later. But Tyrannosaur was one of those things. It was just pure expression. I wrote it in a week and it just
and
sort
flow
of...
flowed the whole
it just
time.
Flowed out, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and I sent it to Gary because I was massively inspired by Neil by Mouth. That just, mm-hmm. you know, when I sat in a theatre and watched that, it just turned my head. And I just sort of went... I sent it to him straight away and then he read it and I rang him up and he went, don't change a fucking thing. And I went, right, okay, I won't. And I tried to sort of change some bits, but it didn't want it. It knew what it wanted to be, Tyrannosaur. It was like a dog shaking off fleas. If I tried to do anything, try and embellish anything or be clever, it went, fuck off. You know, it sort of... So I listened to that and I just let it breathe and be what it wanted to be. But making it, I kind of walked it in my head and I longed for that relationship again, you know.
The relationship with your own creativity?
Yeah.
Like, is that difficult since?
Yeah, because my second film, I didn't achieve the same things with it. And I think in my second film, I got a little bit trapped. It was kind of more ego than anything else. I wanted so desperately to be seen, mm-hmm. in a way. You know, this is the real me. This is who I am. So I wrote, directed and acted in it. And I don't know, something got lost in there somewhere. And it didn't meet the expectations I had for it. And I don't think it's a great film, but it's got good moments in it and good things about it. But
even when you see it being received well, your heart isn't in it the way with Tyrannosaur.
No.
Because we were talking about this backstage and I was saying, like, something that I find that works for me is if you're having trouble writing something or you're trying to go, fuck it, I had so much flow back then, that thing that I made before was so great, deliberately try and make a piece of shit. No, but seriously, because what will keep you from your inner voice is the fear of failing and also, how do I be good? But I bet you when you made Tyrannosaur, you weren't trying to be good.
No, I didn't care.
It was,
yeah.
I don't know what this is. This is authentic. This just feels right, I bet you.
Yeah, it did. It was just pure expression. Yeah, it came out that way. Whereas with the second film, I was making it about a subject matter and I was actually falling into that trap that I feel quite ashamed of. I was trying to second guess what I thought people wanted from me.
Yeah.
And that's something I never thought I'd fall for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd listen to
and
David Bowie.
And you can't
Bowie
create like that.
No, you absolutely cannot.
Oh, sure, Bowie's great for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was just about the authenticity and never make what you think.
Don't play to the gallery. And,
yeah.
You know. And I think I was trying to say, hey, I'm here, you know,
mm-hmm.
accept me somehow. Because that was my relationship with acting. I mean, I've moved on from it since. But that was my relationship with acting. I was talking to Blind Boy backstage and just sort of saying, you know, all this mimicry I did. And then I eventually did a play at school. And I was on report and, you know, in my third year. And I was pretty much pissing my life away at school.
A little bollocks.
Yeah, I was a proper little bollocks. And... but I did this version. I did this school play of Grease, and I went on
Who'd
stage.
Who'd you play in Grease?
I was Kinnicky, fucking typecasted. I said I want to be Danny, and the art teacher went, like, you know, they'd already cast it. I'm like, I think they earmarked me for Kinnicky. But I remember my music teacher giving me the sheet music on the first rehearsal, and it was Grease Lightning, and I went, what's that? And he went, that. I said, I don't sing that, mate. And kind of went to hand it back because you do in the play, mm-hmm. you know, and shoved it back at me. And I went, oh, right. And that became the relationship I had with acting then was interesting because of my father, really, us as kids were kind of labeled. You mm-hmm. know, we'd play with kids in the street. And when it went to going around the house, like, I'd have doors shut in my face and things mm-hmm. like that. You know, I wasn't accepted or allowed in people's houses and things like that. And I hadn't done anything. So I was rebelling against that from a young age. And I wanted people to see me, really. And when I did this version of Grease and I was singing Grease Lightning in this Elvis jumpsuit and everything, it's like everybody's opinion and view of me changed like that. The faculty, the students, everybody. And I thought, oh, I get it now. This is what you have to do to get people to like you.
You're not that confident kid anymore.
Yeah, that's all it was, really, yeah.
And so that was a pivotal moment for you that's the buzz, that was the little, holy fuck, I can do something with this.
Yeah, I can change people's perception of me if I perform, yeah.
Just back to the topic of how are you writing at the moment?
I haven't written a film since my last one, which is a film called Journeyman, and I just haven't been able to do it. I haven't been able to sit down and do it. I can write.
Do you want to?
Yeah. Yeah, I do, yeah. But I'm terrified. And it surprises me because I know what I have to do. But, yeah, I don't know what's going to come out. I don't know if it's going to be any good. I've put myself in a real trap.
But also you have the music side of yourself. So when you go making music, is that like does it give you any sense of freedom or relief from the pain of trying to write a film?
Yeah, I don't have any problem writing songs. It's like the best thing.
Do you ever feel that because you don't put expectations on yourself when you're writing music?
Yeah, because there's no expectations from us. We were like an independent band. We're not signed. We're not managed. We do it all ourselves, you know.
And you paint your face.
Yeah.
What's that about?
It's a little bit of... Says the man with a fucking bag on his head.
I forgot. Fucking hell.
It's a little bit of... There's a little bit of tribal stuff in there. Like older kids than me, their thing was like, and when I first saw Bowie on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
But for me, it was when I saw Adam and the Ants on Top of the Pops. Like that was that moment for me. I remember them playing Dog Eat Dog and being, I don't know, if I was 8, 9 years old or something, and just having that moment of like, what was that? Mm-hmm. Whatever that is, I want to belong to that. So there's sort of some tribal elements to our music and things like that. And the face paint is just steeped in these things of like, you know, the Lone Ranger and things like that, stuff that was on television when I was a kid, and also having a bit of a mask to hide behind a little bit.
Do you feel like Paddy Considine when you're up there singing on stage with the paint on your face?
No, I feel like there's a kind of persona called Gobshite Rambo.
Brilliant.
And he's not mouthy, he's not like, fuck, you know, in all politics, but it's just Gobshite Rambo, yeah, and he's a different creature. And he there's a certain part of the show where he departs because, you know, he loves people, you know.
Gobshite Rambo loves people.
He loves people. He does love people, yeah. He likes the interaction and he feels pride when they sing his songs back to him and things like that, you know.
Have you ever felt that your East Midlands accent holds you back from getting jobs?
I don't think it has, but, you know, I don't think it has. I think I'm okay at accents.
How is England with that particular accent?
Yeah, it's tricky.
Is it?
It's tricky.
Like there I'm is, trying to learn what my ear. Well, like it's not Birmingham.
No, that's it. I think, like, listen, Nottingham claimed me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had this with someone once. They said, you know, you're more Birmingham. I went, no, I think Nottingham claimed
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I wouldn't. There's a bit, really, is there a bit of a scrap going on there?
There's a bit of that. There was.
I wouldn't, I'd like, Jesus, I wouldn't hear Birmingham.
No, it's definitely not in the voice. So it's very, very different, yeah. And I've always had this sort of affiliation with Nottingham through Shane, really, more than anything else, you mm-hmm. know. So, we probably lean towards this side of the Midlands more.
Are the people of Burton and Trent proud of you?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't, you know, I don't get recognised anywhere I go.
Has the mayor ever given you a shout?
No, but some guy rocked up to my house, a councillor, and he wanted to make me... Free man of the borough. And I went, what the fuck is that, man?
What the fuck is that? Jesus Christ. What's that?
And I'm like...
That sounds like it comes with a hat.
Yeah, I know.
Does it come with a hat?
And I just like, does it mean that you can park anywhere you want? Because I'll fucking take it. I don't know. That shit icks me. I'm not good with that. You know, like the local college wanted to give me some sort of degree in performing arts. And I went, I can't accept that. I didn't complete my mm-hmm. fucking BTEC. I'm not going to accept a BA. It's bullshit and it sends the wrong signals to kids. You know, you got to tough it out.
But you should go for the fucking, what was it?
The free man of the borough.
Well, like, they gave a... Bono got given the key to Dublin City, you know? And when he got given the key to Dublin City, Bono went, like, looking into, like, what does it mean? And he found that one of the rules was that he was legally allowed to graze his sheep in Phoenix Park in Dublin.
No.
So he bought a couple of sheep and just fucked them off. Do you know what I mean?
No.
A rare Bono win.
I don't know what it would get me, but I just, you know, it's you know, titles and that. I'm not sorry.
I don't think Freeman of the Borough is like, it's not like Sir and MBE.
No, that's I mean, you know, I'm not getting above myself here.
That's much more. Freeman of the Borough is like, I don't know, you serve Robin Hood a pint. It doesn't have that feeling.
Like I walk around doing that to everybody.
It's jestery. There's something jestery about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's strange.
Freeman of the Borough, what does that mean? I'd have great difficulty not accepting that if I was given that.
I'm just ungrateful.
I forgot my fucking sheet of questions again, Paddy. They were handed to me at the side of stage. What's your favourite type of dog?
Oh, Cavalier King Charles.
Here, thank you, Darren. This is Darren. He's from Nottingham. He's taught me everything about Nottingham. He's actually the reason I did a gig here, because the last time I was doing a tour, he goes, you know, there's a lot of caves in Nottingham. And I'm like, go on. Actually, the questions are fucking shit, man.
Are they?
Jesus, that's not even a question.
How did you start out?
What the fuck was I thinking when I wrote these, man? The first one, how did you start out? This one isn't even a question. It just says,
You've been friends with Shane Meadows.
Yeah. Then the other one is, what was Barton on Trent like? What the fuck was I doing, man?
When? What was it like?
Then there's this one, which isn't even... I said, tell us about your love of Northern Soul. I asked you backstage. You don't love Northern Soul
at all.
Well,
I like Northern Soul music, but I don't turn up with my talcum powder and my flares on, you know.
What do you mean, talcum powder? Why is talcum powder involved in Northern Soul?
Because they put it on the floor so they can dance and move and slide on it.
Is that the crack?
Yeah, yeah.
This isn't a very Northern Soul-y area. It's not... You're not in the North. You're in the Midlands, in the East.
Yeah, we're the Midlands. You have to go up to Wigan and that. That was the prime place for Northern Soul, I think.
You directed a video for Roisin Murphy. And
no,
you,
I was you, in it.
You danced Northern Soul in the video.
And I had to learn how to dance Northern Soul, which I didn't do. But I fucking tried, you know. I really did. I did my best.
It's a fascinating type of dancing. Like, because I have a theory that... I don't know if you remember rave dancing from the early 90s. But like, there were certain moves in rave dancing, foot moves in particular. You'd see the Leroy from The Prodigy doing them. And I'm convinced that rave dancing came from Northern Soul.
That's a podcast, isn't it?
It's done. It was one of my first podcasts, man. That was one of my first podcasts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just see a similarity of moves. And like, I love Northern Soul. I wouldn't find myself listening to the music loads. I'm like, how the fuck did that happen?
Yeah.
How did that happen? I ended up finding out. So, certain cities around the north of England, right, it was in the cities that had a lot of coal. So, the cities that had a lot of coal, they were sending this coal on ships to Detroit in America. And when they sent the ship off full of this fucking coal, when it got to Detroit, it let all its weight off because coal is heavy. So, then when it gets back to the north of England, they needed a ballast. So, in Detroit, they're rubbish. Were Motown records that didn't sell.
Yeah.
So they'd fill the fucking boat with this Motown B-sides that no one wanted. They'd make it back to the north, get thrown onto the docks as rubbish, and then cafe owners who were cheap would pick up these records of like Grace Jones and stuff and then just start putting it in the cafes instead of paying for Elvis. And that's how Northern Soul happened. But isn't that lovely, isn't that?
I love that.
I think that's fascinating. And then you have all these kids fetishizing, and then you've got singers over in Detroit getting phone calls going, they love you in England.
Yeah, come
Where's
over and
that?
Perform. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I love watching Northern Soul dancing. I think it's the best.
And it's still going too. I've seen on YouTube, there's still people doing Northern Soul championships.
Yeah, they have all-nighters and things like that. They used to do one near us in Burton.
They used to do speed, but it wasn't speed. It was like a Dexy's Midnight Runners.
Hey. Yeah.
Dexy's Midnight Runners was a phrase that was taken from Northern Soul, where it's Dexedrine or some type of drug, which was like speed, and that's what they used to take. Because there was no drink at the Northern Soul discos.
Right. There you go. That's amazing. No, it's...
Right, let's see what other questions I have here, Paddy.
Come on. Come on, blind boy.
Jesus, man, these are bad questions. So that one is about your band, right? We got that one out of the way. This is like, do you know anything about the caves underneath nothing?
No.
And then the last one is, have you found your East Midlands accent limiting? What the fuck? I think my ma was ringing me or something on the phone when I was trying to write these down. I was thinking, I won't need any questions for this cunt. We'll just start talking about stuff. Yeah. But your favourite dog is a King Charles Cavalier.
Yeah.
Is it because you owned one?
We've had two, yeah. We had one who died at Christmas we'd had for like 12 years, Mr. Bodog. And now we've got Manny. I fucking love him, mate.
Why is he called Manny?
I don't know. My wife named him, actually.
It's not after your man in the Stone Roses?
No, it'd be after Manny Pacquiao, the boxer.
What's their temperament like?
Oh, man. Listen, they come and have a cuddle with you and... You know, they want to play and that. I love them to bits. And they're handsome, beautiful doggies.
I wouldn't call a King Charles Cavalier handsome.
Don't you?
They'd be like, no, handsome is fucking... What's handsome?
I don't like big dogs that lie in your fucking...
Labradors are handsome.
You know, they're in your living room, like, and their bollocks are out and they're fucking all like that. That's what I don't like.
No, are the slobbering ones. Like, I mean, fair play to people who adore the slobbering dogs.
Yeah, but I don't like that.
I don't need dog fluid in my life.
Some fucking Labradors.
Does King Charles Cavalier get any unique health issues because of its breeding?
Yeah, it's heart. They have heart problems.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A little fella died of a heart attack at Christmas.
And was he before his time?
No, he had a good life. He was about 12 and a half.
That's pretty good going.
Yeah, it is for them, yeah. What else can
pugs,
we fucking
talk pugs,
about?
Man. No. Pugs can die if they fall over. Yeah. Pugs, there's a lot of dog breeds, lad. They kind of shouldn't exist, you know? The French were the real culprits for this. Like, the King Charles Cavalier, I believe, has French ancestry, and it was literally bred to be, like, in a handbag, a small little dog. Like, dogs at one point were wolves. You know what I mean? How the fuck do you go from a wolf to a King Charles Cavalier? But then you've got a pug. Pugs, the shape of their face. If a pug falls over in the wrong way, they can't get back up and they drown in their own face. Seriously. And they get tremendous hip problems. And then we've got, in Ireland, we've got the Irish Wolfhound. They're fucking huge, like, they're about 5 foot tall. But, like, they're based on rumours of what an Irish Wolfhound was like 1,000 years ago. So Irish Wolfhounds, their lungs just fill up with fluid and they die when they're five. Yeah, very, very sad life for an Irish Wolfhound. God. You're better off with a mongrel. Because
yeah,
you
we had
well,
a mongrel.
If you get a King Charles Cavalier and go out into the estate and find something... At least that dog is choosing its mate. So you start getting a fucking... Jack Russell could have a crack at a King Charles Cavalier. Do you ever get really bored and you go onto Google and you just go, I wonder what dogs have fucked. They have all fucked. Trust me. A Doberman King Charles Cavalier exists. Someone has done it. If they couldn't make it happen naturally, they use the turkey baster. I'm fucking telling you. Sorry, Paddy. That's how they do it. I don't know that information. That was me using my imagination going, how would you possibly breed? They're not doing it artificially anyway. It's something going on out of the back garden. You fond of cats?
No. I'm not a cat man.
Why?
No, I don't fucking like them. They're sneaky. No.
Listen, that sneaky thing. No, you got to get a Noah cat. Cats are sneaky because it's like you got to put in effort.
I don't like them. They're aloof and weird.
They are aloof.
I like dogs because they're fucking stupid.
Cats, they're very clean though.
Are they? Yeah.
A cat has a well-groomed anus.
A well-rimmed cat.
What do you think about people who have fish tanks?
Oh man, I tried. The amount of dead fish.
Did you ever go at that?
Oh, fucking hell, man. I'd come down that many times that the fish would be like that, like a stick. We had this one fish, and it was my youngest daughter's fish. And I came to the tank, and for months it was on its side, and we put medicine in to try and help it. And it wasn't doing anything. I came down one morning, it was floating on the top, and I knocked the tank, and I went, yeah, come on, because usually you'd knock it and they'd go like that and swim off. And this time it just stayed, and I went, I think it's dead. So I give it another knock. fucking dead, didn't move. And I got the net, and I hooked this fish up, didn't move, dead. And I get to the toilet, I think I'm going to have to flush this poor thing down the toilet. I lift up the toilet lid. One of the kids has left a massive fucking turd in there and not and not flushed it. So I go like that with the net and I go, oh God, I may as well just... I flip the fish, it lands on the turd and comes to life. And starts doing that. And I just went, oh, fuck it, and flushed it.
What if... What if, Paddy, you had just discovered a major medical breakthrough that no one has tried before? What if that's it? What if we don't have to die? What if
just
when you
jump
die,
into a pile of
you just
shit.
Fucking get someone who's dying and just put them on top of a giant child's turd? The shit of children, Paddy. What was it like working on House of the Dragon?
Fucking hell. It was all right, man. Yeah, it was all right. A year in a wig. It was nice. No, it was a good... I enjoyed House of the Dragon. I thought it was a great, you know, character. You know, it was one of those rare times as an actor that I could access that same stuff that I did when I was doing Tyrannosaur, you know. So it was easy to look at it and go, oh, it's just some fucking fantasy spin-off thing. But when I read it, I could see a real great character in there, and I thought it was a gift. So it doesn't matter to me what the framework is and what it comes like. If there's a character in there worth playing, I want to do it. So
what was it like working on something that huge, though? Is that not terrifying? Is that like is that's massive. There's a lot of crew.
There is, yeah. We shot that for about a year, but...
Where did you shoot it?
I was mainly in a studio. I was mainly at Leavesden Studio.
Was it all this LED screen shit?
No, I did very little of that. A lot of
was
my
it
stuff.
Sets, actual sets?
Yeah, I was in okay, sets a lot yeah. of the time. So it was just like doing a play or something. So it never felt big in that way.
Okay, so they compartmentalised it so that you're over here doing your scenes and then someone else doing something else in the other part of the world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's about three different like film units working on different episodes all at once.
And have you ever done any of that stuff where... it's just green screen all around you, or an LED screen. Like, you're not there at all.
I've done a little bit of it.
Where you're talking to a tennis ball.
Yeah, that sort of... Well, when I did Romeo Brass, I was talking to a tennis ball in some of them scenes.
Like, what's that like? Is that difficult?
It depends who you fucking acting opposite. Probably sometimes the tennis ball's fucking better.
Wow!
But I had to do a scene in Romeo Brass where they couldn't fit the actors in onto the couch where the camera was, and I'm telling a ghost story in it, and I'm telling it to a tennis ball, so you know you get used to that kind of stuff quite quickly. But the worst thing about the green screen stuff, which I haven't done a lot of, is that it's not very interactive.
No.
So this table would be green screen. You mm-hmm. know, everything around, all the elements around you were green screen, so it's not that realistic. But when I did House of the Dragon, they were all built sets, so it never really made any difference. You just like being on the stage, you know.
Have you ever been on one of those sets? There's a new thing now, I don't know what it's called, but instead of a green screen,
the volume,
it's a huge, like this would be one gigantic fucking LED screen, and
yeah,
the world is around you there.
Yeah, I did that. I did one day of that on House of the Dragon.
What's that? That would drive me mad.
It's what's really mad about it is that we were approaching, I can't remember whose fucking castle it was. It's all going out of my mind now. But we were walking up to it, and as you walk up to it, as you get closer to it, the actual thing moves like you're walking towards it and gets closer in perspective to you.
How was that for you as an actor, to like the spectacle of that? That sounds like being at Disneyland.
Yeah, it is like that.
Remember, but did you get a sense of when you're acting going, fucking hell, or the castle's going to kill me? Like, do you remember that first? Remember
it's
when they first
fall on me.
Do you remember when they showed that film to the people in the 1910s and it was a train?
Yeah.
There's some famous film where they put a camera on a train track and it was like 1910 and everyone ran out of the cinema. Because the train yeah. was coming towards them.
They used to do that at Alton Towers.
Go away, did they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Does anyone remember in the 80s or 90s?
I've only heard of Alton Towers. This is an English thing that
yeah,
we hear
like
about in Ireland.
Yeah, it's like a theme park. They used to have this big dome called Cinema 3000 or whatever. Remember that? And you'd like there'd be a car driving through Paris, and you just all stand like that watching it. And then at some point it breaks and everyone would sort of go like that and fall forward. It's a similar thing, really.
Was it enjoyable?
Yeah, I thought it was wank when I went. I was just sort of like, what's the big deal?
I'm going to ask questions from the audience now.
Yeah, hi, I'm a massive fan.
Oh, how are you? What's the crack?
Yeah, I've always wanted to know, what's your favourite sandwich? From like bread to your main filling to your subgenre filling and everything.
The first thing that came into my head there is a pastrami sandwich. I do enjoy pastrami sandwiches.
Nice, yeah. I remember when Pret a Manger opened and I thought Coronation Chicken was the absolute business.
Really?
Yeah, I loved it.
I find that a particularly colonial lunch and I don't like it for that reason. But it is. First off, it's named after your one's fucking coronation, Elizabeth. Her coronation, and then it's like, oh, what are you doing, you cheeky cunts? You're putting curry in there, is it? Why are you doing that? Oh, because you took over India. Okay. So I don't like coronation chicken because of there's colonial. It's a colonial sandwich, so I'm not into that.
Yeah, I'll just eat the fucker.
You wouldn't have another question. This gentleman up front. Bang of MI5 off this cunt now. I'm waiting for the plans.
It's a question for Paddy. How did it feel watching somebody else play a character that you played yourself? Think about Rob Gretton.
I didn't feel anything. No, I don't often do. No, I thought it was... You mean Toby, don't you? Who played my brother in Dead Man's Shoes. No, I thought it was great. Yeah, it didn't bother me. I really liked Control. I thought it was a great film. There's just two different things and two different interpretations. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good film.
Two great films.
Yeah. I think they both were in their own way. I really liked playing Rob. It made me a legend in Manchester.
How do you feel about all the Dead Man's Shoes memes now? Like, there's a generation of kids who are familiar with that through memes of your performances.
That's true, yeah. That's interesting.
Is that weird? Like, it's decontextualized completely.
Yeah.
They think it's a documentary.
They do.
Yeah.
what life was like.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a strange legacy Dead Man's Shoes has. There's a certain audience that love that film, you know.
Is it frightening and toxic?
Kind of. There's that element to it a little bit sometimes, you know. I remember being at a music festival and a guy stopped me, like practically grabbed me, and he went, "Don't fucking move." And I went, "All right, mate." And he went, "Yeah." And he whipped his top off and he had this tattoo on his back and his whole back was a picture of me about that fucking big. and myself there and Toby. And he had this big Dead Man Shoes back tattoo. I was like, fucking hell. And then like there was an incident when the kids were younger. We were sat in a Pizza Express and someone banged on the window and I turned around and they went, "You're fucking there, mate." Cheers.
Do you not get a bit of anxiety when you see it going viral on TikTok?
Well, I don't have TikTok, you know.
You don't have to. The children do.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't really... I'm not... I kind of don't know what's going on in that respect. But it's 20 years this year.
Yes.
And I think they're going to re-release it. And, you know, we'll do a few bits and pieces around it. But
Fuck off, really?
Yeah.
People would love that.
Yeah, like, I think they will.
Out of politeness, I didn't bring the film up.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I just think it's a respectful thing to do.
Yeah. I don't mind it. You know, it's a long time ago now. But... it's just incredible to me that it keeps circling around again and another generation. And
because it's fucking brilliant.
Yeah, I guess.
It's fucking brilliant. And maybe it's going to be brilliant in 50 years. Like, it's just fucking brilliant.
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions?
Yeah,
I enjoy that. It sounded like a distant macaw.
Hi. Oh, my God, that's weird. I just want to start off by saying thank you for coming to Nottingham. Tonight's been great.
Thank you, you wonderful people.
So this is for both of you, really. I'm just wondering, have you, either of you or both of you, experienced prejudice in your industry, like the creative industries, because of your autism? And if you have, how have you tackled that?
Yeah, all the time, but people don't know it's because of autism. Do you know what I mean? That's a hard one to answer.
Yeah.
No one's going to go like, fuck off, Mr. Autism.
Yeah.
But my whole career, if you want to write books, right? If you want to write books, you want to become a book writer. There's a path, and that path is do well in school, then get into university where you study literature. Then once you study literature, you become very social and you go to loads of these social events with other writers where you're consistently social, making friends, networking, and that's the path of how you eventually get published. I do not have access to that. I never had access to that because I'm autistic.
Yeah.
First off, I failed fucking school because of autism, being a little shit. And then secondly, there's no way in hell that I can go to literary meetings and network and meet people. I'm a fucking loner. So that's an excellent question, but it's so difficult to pinpoint. I'm an awkward, odd, strange man because I'm autistic. Blind boy, would you like to do this documentary here? This documentary could change your career. Yes, I'd love to. You're going to have to take that bag off, though. In a way, I wear this bag because I'm autistic and I'd love to make a documentary and for it to be on TV and for everyone to know it, but I'm not fucking getting accosted in Pret a Manger the next day or whatever you call it.
With your coronation chicken sandwich.
With my fucking coronation chicken sandwich and having a stranger coming up to me and saying, how about that coronation chicken? And then I go on a colonialism rant and it's in the Daily Mail. So it's such a big question. It's like... being autistic is fucking difficult no matter where the fuck you are because you're an eccentric, strange person and the world does not work for you if you're that way.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
Well, I think that's interesting, the eccentric thing, because I do think a lot of actors that I know, whether they're, you know, on any kind of spectrum or whatever, are eccentric. So I think it's one of the few places that you can sort of go.
How do you feel about a red carpet? How do you feel about sitting on a red carpet while a bunch of people say, Paddy, stand there and smile while we take a photograph?
That's probably the worst thing, you know. And I don't do them regularly. But the last one I did, you know, I had a couple of them before it. I hate to say that. But I did.
But that's most likely some of your neurodivergence.
Yeah.
The fact that you're uncomfortable with it, the fact that you can look at other actors who are like, I don't care, Paddy, just stand in front and do it.
Yeah.
And you're like, I can't fucking do this. I need to get smashed.
Yeah, I find that. It's those sort of things, those social things that I struggle with the most. And things like photo shoots even, you know, I did, you know, when you turn up and someone's got a fucking rail full of clothes and it's like, I can't compute that, you know. Mm-hmm. Try this, even costume fittings for characters, try this on, I'll try that with that, and I'm just sort of going, I can't fucking do this, you know, I can't.
What is that specific, is it a fabric texture thing or just the confusion or?
Yeah, I just think it's that, I don't know, it sounds really odd to say, but there's a sort of vulnerability to it. Mm-hmm. So even going in the room and having to fucking change your clothes in a room, you know, or try clothes on that don't feel like they suit you, but mm-hmm. then you've got to play a character. You mm-hmm. know, I actually don't. I like when I finished a job, it's done, and I don't look at it again. Mm-hmm. I'm fucking done with it, you know, mostly. It's that lack of you have to act and to do that stuff, you have to surrender some sort of self control to it. Mm-hmm. You just have to, and there's other people making decisions about you and your kind of physical being, if you like.
The neurotypical actor isn't going to give a fuck. They're just going to get on with
it. No, they just do it.
For you, it's a huge source of stress.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that gets you labelled as strange or difficult.
That's right,
it might get in the way of opportunities.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, that's the invisible thing.
I suffered that thing of, like, you know, you don't do press and that's affecting you getting work. And it's like, yeah. Well, I don't really like talking about, you know, I'm here now talking, but...
That's different, but
you knew we were
going to have the crack. I'm not going to fucking ask you fucking...
And it's fucking...
Do you like Netflix? I don't know, even know what a real question is. Whatever Graham Norton's going to ask you, he wouldn't ask that. I can't imagine Graham Norton going, Paddy Considine, do you like Netflix?
But if I am going to do if I'm going to do a chat show or anything like that, I have to prepare beforehand.
Yeah.
And what's helped me massively with what I kind of have or what I deal with is just, like, looking after myself. A bit mm-hmm. more like exercising. It sounds really silly, exercising, stretching, meditating, mm-hmm. just doing things to prepare myself for certain things. It's almost like if I go to a music festival, I'm going, people are going to come up to you and they're going to want to meet you and they're going to have a photo with you, and you've got to prepare yourself for it, because you can't, I can't be that guy either that just goes, oh, fuck off, mate.
Yeah.
You know?
Or I'm not going to that music festival that I want to go to.
Yeah, I'm
going to
avoid
scared.
It because of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're always in a state of hypervigilance. I'm always in a state that I think something bad is going to happen. Mm-hmm. So if I'm at Rock City watching a gig with my family, I'm hypervigilant most of the time, because I think if someone knocks them or knocks me or does it, and I'm at a fucking gig, people are mm-hmm. jumping around, but it puts me in this other sort of stress zone in a way, you know, that something bad's going to happen at some point.
So, like, the thing is, and I can relate to so much of that, we've been that way our entire fucking lives.
Yeah.
So we tend not to think of what it would be like to not be that way.
Yeah.
But people who aren't neurodivergent, they're not dealing with this. They're just going to the gig.
Yeah. And I can observe that and see that in people. And I can talk to myself and go, look, they're just having a good time, you know. And sometimes it robs you of a good time.
100%, yeah. You know? Yeah.
Because that's all you're thinking about. But I'm looking at people going, these guys are just having a really good time. And, you know, they're letting go. Why can't you just do that? And sometimes I can, to a degree. And I enjoy myself. Mm-hmm. But there's always that thing in my mind. Like, I always think something bad's going to happen. Even if I go to the petrol station to fill my car, I might get into a fight. I might have to, you know, something's going to go wrong or whatever. It's just something that I've had to live with and deal with.
And that's just what, like, that's the stress and pressure of having the brain that you have your entire life, and the amount of times that the brains that we have get us into trouble.
Yeah.
Like, how much stupid shit have we done when we were kids for not understanding the rules? You're supposed to look people into the eye. You're a rude little cunt. Why aren't you looking me in the eye? It all gathers up, and then you're an adult with, like, I have to second guess my environment.
Yeah. You
know, so it's a consistent stress that you live with it so much as normality. But if you, I'd like, Jesus Christ, sometimes my nightmare scenario would be if I could live in a neurotypical person's brain for a day.
What would that be like?
I think I'd hate it.
Yeah.
Because then I'd be aware of how stressful it is to be me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'd go, oh my God, this is it. I'm just worried about, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't have to memorize facts about dogs' anuses. You mean I can just go and buy orange juice and say, how are you getting on? How's the weather? Great. How is your son? Fantastic. I'll talk to you later, Maura. I'd love to be able to do that. I can't fucking do that. Any other questions? There's a very flaccid microphone here in Nottingham. It keeps running away from me.
Oh, there's another one.
Oh, fuck it. All right, go on. Usher, if you wouldn't mind. That sounds like a kookaburra. Very common bird.
There's a Hives fan on the front row.
A Hives fan.
They're such a fucking great band.
Are they Swedish, is it? Where are the Hives from? Yeah.
Amazing. Did you go to Rock City the other week? Oh, did you? We were there. We were there too, man. It was great, wasn't it?
Their last music video was fucking class, where they're like, they're in an office. They're like in a board meeting or something. I love that.
Yeah.
So Paddy, sorry.
Go on.
It's a question for you both. Paddy, I saw you, I think it was at the red carpet moment.
Did I tell you to fuck off?
No, sorry, where am I looking? But you just finished, I think it was after Journeyman, and you'd managed to get it, you know, out there. And she was like, so how do you feel? And you're like, oh, fuck, it was such a fucking hard work. Like, getting the money was hard. Getting people out to see it is hard. Getting a film produced, man, it's just such fucking hard work. Yeah. And like, you probably had a few.
Yeah, probably. No, I hadn't then, actually.
Okay.
I wasn't having a beer in them days, right, so yeah, right. I was just fucking fed up.
But I was wondering, you know, what makes it worth it for you both? Because it's obviously a struggle to
What makes it worth it for me? Sometimes that window opens where you can escape, and I'm not trying to sound like an arsehole here, where you connect to something that's otherworldly. And don't get me wrong, acting in that film Journeyman, I touched that, but as a project, I don't feel like it came together. But for me, it's those little pockets of escape when I'm connected to something that I feel that isn't I'm not, it's not mine. It's not in my control. It's that creative thing inside. And that's the thing that I'm always searching for in everything. When something just flows through you, whether it's a lyric, whether it's a moment in a scene, whether it's a screenplay, and you kind of sit back and go, did I even write that? Did I even do that? You know, and I've had it in theatre. Theatre was a really great place for it, but sometimes everything would disappear. There was, everything just went black. And there was just myself and the actress stood in front of me. And I think sometimes the dangerous thing and also the kind of exotic thing about what I pursue is that escape from reality, because sometimes reality is really hard. But, and when you tap into that divine sort of flow thing, it's such an incredible thing that I want it all the time. And that's the only way I can.
I give the exact same 100% answer. That's insane. Honest to fucking God. The dragon that I chase is that feeling of flow, that feeling of, you've described it perfectly. It's like, I don't know where this came from, but when I'm there, this is amazing and I feel like this is what life is. And that's why I do it too. And all the other shit around it, it's worth it.
Yeah.
If I can just get that bit of fucking flow, oh my God.
Yeah.
Peace on earth. It's incredible.
It feels great. It really elevates you, and I'm just sort of like, where did that come from? It's like a mystery almost, but it feels like a gift. And when it comes, it's such a brilliant thing.
And the agony of when you can't access it.
It's horrible. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It really is. And a lot of times when you go to work in acting, you're not given the opportunity to access mm-hmm. it. You're just not. It's not there for you.
Any other questions? There's a lot of people up there as well. Do we have a quantum superposition of ushers? Well, there's another usher up there. We do. Does anybody have a question? I'm sorry about ye poor cunts up there. It's just the lights are in my eyes and I forgot that there was a lot of people up there. Do you have any questions up there? You can honk like an interesting
hello,
animal.
Hello.
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 Go on.
Yeah, so thank you for tonight. Firstly.
You're welcome.
I just really wanted you to talk about submarine, basically.
Talk about submarines.
Submarines.
Blind
yeah.
boy, what do you know about submarines?
You're taking the piss.
I'm actually not taking the piss.
Okay, Jesus Christ.
The film.
Oh, all right, film okay. Submarine. Okay. All right. Grant, because I was like ready to like I know.
To go.
Jesus, do I know about fucking submarines? Well. Fuck me. I was like, is this a plant? You go on, you continue, you talk about submarine.
Well, I don't know what about it. Where am I looking? Sorry.
You know what? I think I might have thought that you were in it, so...
I think I thought I might have been in it as well.
Well, can you pretend that you were in it, please?
Okay.
And tell me what it was like to be in it.
It was great to be in it. I had a fantastic wig, a fantastic mullet. It was wonderful. I had fantastic clothes, fantastic style. And a fantastic wife. It was absolute bliss.
Can I answer the question that I thought you were asking about submarines? So wait till you hear this. The submarine was actually invented in Ireland. I'm serious. No, I'm dead serious. In about 1880... I can't remember the man's name, John Francis something, right? So there's an area off the west coast of Ireland called Kilkee, off Clare. And this fella was just like, he made boats. And then he was like, why can't I have one that goes underneath the ground? Is that fly on your hand?
Fly with me, blind boy.
Fucking St. John the Baptist here. So while the fly is on his knuckle, I'll explain the history of submarines while a man paints it. So listen... This fella in like 1890, an Irish fella, was like, why can't boats go underwater? So he built one. He built this submarine. But the thing was, the world didn't need submarines yet. Warfare hadn't gotten to that point. So this Irish fella who'd made the world's first submarine, he goes to America and brings his submarine with him, hoping that the Americans will buy his submarine. And the Americans are like, I don't know what this is for. Why do we need to go under the water? Stop it. You're being mad. But while he's in New York trying to sell his submarine to the fucking Yanks, the Irish Republican Brotherhood, who are like, they're like the IRA, but they're in America, the IRB. the IRB see the Irish fella with this submarine invention and they go, we want that. And he's like, no, you can't have it. No, we're taking it. So the IRA in America take the submarine and they change its name from a submarine into a Fenian ram. So it was this underwater ship in 1890 that they... There's the fly again on my microphone.
It's getting bold.
The IRA in America wanted to sink British ships with this underwater ship. But then after they'd stolen the fucking ship, they're like, we don't know how to use it. And we're after pissing off the one dude who invented it because we were mean to him. So the IRA are like, shit, okay, we've got this strange submarine ship and we can't use it. What are we going to do with it? So they start touring the submarine around America in museums, right? As here's this submarine that can go underwater. It's in a museum. Give us some money to look at it. But while they're doing this, this Italian man shows up and he's a baker. This is like 1895. This is all true. An Italian man shows up who's a baker. And while he sees this submarine, he goes, bet you I can make some bread like that. So he invents the sub roll. And Subway, when you go into Subway, you're eating a piece of bread that's designed after an IRA submarine from the 1890s. And that dude who invented the first submarine, he then went on to work for the US Navy and invented the first ever American submarine. That's all fact. That's fact. That's what I have pre-prepared if I meet anyone in Subway. What's up with that fly?
I know.
That's very interesting, isn't it? Because yeah. there's a whole... Has the fly been to anyone else, no? There's a lot of people here. And I keep... That's an MI5 fly. that's some type of MI5 drone now. It's on my knuckle and scanning my eyes.
Yeah, it's left tell a him, chip tell him in Prince or
Charles
something.
Or King Charles, whatever he is. They're just celebrities to us, lads. I'm going to take one last question. What a mad podcast, Paddy. This has been a bit strange, hasn't it?
Yeah, but it's been good, yeah? I think it's been good.
I've had great,
I've fucking enjoyed myself.
How are you getting on, Andy, with the painting? Are you happy with that, yeah? Is the fly involved? Okay.
Make it, yeah.
Any other questions? I'll take one last question because it's 10 o'clock.
Yeah, Blind Boy, what's your favourite biscuit?
So you get the tough ones, Blind Boy.
Do you know... I've never tasted a Garibaldi and I fetishize it. So I'm going to say... I'm going to go with Garibaldi because I've never had one. I don't think I ever will. I'd like to keep it as the mystery biscuit. And I like the way it looks like a digestive that you killed a lot of flies with. And it's named after an Italian general for some reason. So I'll go with Garibaldi and never, I'm never going to eat one, ever. It is 22 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and you probably have to get trains and buses. This has been a wonderful night.
I'm going to cut it there. I'm going to cut it just there. Usually what I do at the end of a live podcast is I leave in the bit where I say thank you to my guest, thank you to my audience. But you see, when I do that at the gig, I raise my voice. I shouldn't raise my voice because we've got a microphone, but I raise my voice to say thank you to my guest, thank you to my audience. And when I raise my voice, it's just a little bit too loud to be playing for ye on the podcast. So I cut that bit out so that ye didn't... I didn't have to tell you this at all. I didn't have to tell you this at all. That's why I didn't include the bit where I said thank you Nottingham, thank you to my guest. I can do it here. Thank you Nottingham. For the wonderful podcast. Thank you to my wonderful guest, Paddy Considine, for being a great sport. It was a wonderful night. I'll leave you go now, and I'll be back next week with a hot take. I have some ideas floating around my head. Rub a dog, wink at a swan, step over a worm. Dog bless.
Hey,
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.